Mormon Matters Podcast is a production of the Open Stories Foundation and is seeking to build financial support separate from Mormon Stories Podcast. All donations to Mormon Matters are fully tax deductible and go directly towards keeping the podcast alive and towards building a community of support for Mormons like you. To support the podcast or to join the community, please become a monthly subscriber today at mormonmatters.org.
Welcome, everyone, to another edition of the Mormon Matters Podcast. This is your host, Dan Weatherspoon. And this is about the fourth time you've heard my crazy voice here in the last 10 days because it's been a busy time in Mormonism. We had the Temple Garments video come out that we did a little podcast on. We had Meet the Mormons come out in theaters in the last couple of weeks. We did a podcast on that. There was the rumors of temple sealing, not having to wait after a civil marriage for a year, and even perhaps requiring that came up. We didn't end up doing a podcast, but we did discuss that on other things. But in the news cycle was the biggie, which is the long-awaited Church Gospel Topics essays on polygamy or plural marriage came out. There had been one that had been sitting out there for quite a while, and it was sort of, I think a lot of people in general thought it was the tamest, the least controversial era of polygamy, which is the Utah period. Certainly nobody ever enjoys talking about polygamy at any time, I don't think, and I'll see if our guests agree with that statement here in a minute. But that one had been out for a while, but the ones that talk about the early origins of polygamy, plural marriage in Kirtland and Nauvoo, and then the end of polygamy, the manifesto and the end of plural marriage, those are the two new essays that came out on the church's website this week. And we've got three wonderful people who are active in polygamy discussions quite a bit in Mormonism to be on the show. And I'll just have each one of them introduce themselves if they will. And Barbara Brown, would you mind giving everybody 30 seconds to a minute or two about who you are and your interest in this topic and all that kind of stuff?
My name is Barbara Jones Brown, and I have a master's degree in American history from the University of Utah. I've written quite a bit about post-manifesto polygamy in Mexico. I wrote a biography of a woman named Lorna Call Alder who was born and raised in 1906 in the colonies of Mexico. And I've written a few essays on the topic. I have an essay coming out soon from the University of New Mexico Press in a book titled Just South of Zion, which talks about Mormons in Mexico. And I had just completed a chapter on post-manifesto polygamy in Mexico for a book titled Persistence of Polygamy, Volume 3, turned that in, and then the next morning woke up to all the hubbub.
Wow.
These latest posts on LDS.org, so it was kind of an uncanny coincidence.
Extra readers for your article, probably, because of the timing.
So
that's neat. Hey, well, thanks for being on. Barbara and I have been friends for a few years, and I'm thrilled to finally get her on this podcast.
Thanks for asking me, Dan.
Todd Compton, you wrote one of the classic books in polygamy thing, and certainly been working on this for many years. When did In Sacred Loneliness come out? Tell us that stuff. Tell us about that, as well as anything else you've done on the subject lately.
Yeah, In Sacred Loneliness came out in 1997, and it's a group biography of Joseph Smith's 33 wives. Those are the 33 wives that I felt I could document adequately at that time. After that, I've written articles on polygamy, including an article on marriage age in that same series Barbara mentioned, Persistence of Polygamy. Article on marriage age in Nauvoo polygamy.
Did you mention what either one of you, what press is bringing out the Persistence in Polygamy series?
I think is it John Whitmer Books, Todd, that publishes this?
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
Yeah,
right.
Three volumes.
They're edited by Newell Bringhurst and Craig Foster.
Oh, that's right.
And I believe Brian has published in that series as well, haven't you, Brian? Sorry, Todd, I'm kind of...
No, that's fine.
Brian Hales is our third guest, and we'll have him jump in a second. But go ahead, Todd. So anything else you want to share with us about your background and interest in the topic?
No, I agree with you about no one ever wants to talk about polygamy because, you know, polygamy is our Mormon family history. You know, if you have background in early church members. And, you know, there's wonderful, fascinating stories with polygamy. And, you know, obviously sometimes they're tragic. You know, sometimes they're funny. They're often wonderful stories. So, and I hope a lot of that came through in my book, In Sacred Loneliness. End of story for now.
Okay, thanks. And thank you for being on. I really appreciate having you here, Todd.
Thank you.
Brian Hales, you are probably the most prolific guy publishing on polygamy lately. Would you tell us about the series that you've been doing and your own interests in the subject and any of that good stuff?
Well, I had a family member who joined the All Red Polygamy Group back in 89, and that was the thing that got me interested in it. And since then, I've authored or co-authored 6 volumes dealing with Mormon polygamy. And my wife and I are actually working on a new volume, about 350 pages. It's kind of a condensation of the 3 volumes that came out in 2013, entitled Joseph Smith and Nauvoo Polygamy, Separating Fact from Fiction. And that'll be out early 2015. We're excited about that. My wife has been helping me with that, so it has a little better tone than probably some of the other things I've written. So,
Brian, tell us your wife's name.
My wife is Laura.
And you've barely married, right? Just in the last couple of years?
We married just over a year ago, and she has a master's degree in professional writing. And together we've had a really good time trying to decide what's important. And she disagrees with me on a few things that are in the trilogy that I did. And so we've been able to come up with a kind of a new product that is a lot shorter, be a lot cheaper, and hopefully be something that regular church members will find to be useful.
Nice. And will that one be from Coford? I know at least your main 3 volumes are from Coford.
Yes, it'll be a paperback, hopefully keeping the costs down and be appealing to a greater audience.
Good. Well, thank you for being on, Brian. Really appreciate you.
It's my pleasure.
Saying yes to this. So, okay, listeners, here's the plan, and we're going to do our best to stick with it. We're not going to debate polygamy. We're going to do our best to focus as much as we can on the statements themselves that came out. We know that these came out from the church, so they have a church's stamp of approval on them. But we know that there had to be a big committee work, lots of different scholars, I'm sure general authorities weighing in and things like this. So we had these statements that came out. Does everyone feel good that we're going to at least, can I stipulate that we're glad that the church put something out, and that would you all agree at least here in the beginning, just short comments, that they at least said something about where the major, you know, hot button issues are? And we can kind of talk later about what they may have left out, but would y'all at least stipulate, or can we stipulate that it was a good thing? Barbara, I'll just start with you. And
sure.
We don't always need to go in this order, but we'll do it for this first little round.
Yes. I have nothing but praise for the church for taking this step forward to open the conversation, to talk about these issues, and to put it on their website. It is a monumental step forward. So I have nothing but praise for that. I have some criticisms, if you will, where I think the essays could be improved.
Right, and we'll definitely do that.
But
we'll
just to start on that page, yes, it's I think it's a historic day in church history, the fact that the church openly talked about this issue to the extent that they did on its website.
Awesome. Todd, do you feel in good with the general stipulation that it was a thumbs up?
Yeah, I agree with Barbara that I think it's like a historic day that they've, you know, openly on a church publication dealt with these, you know, really problematic issues, you know, and so I really applaud them. So I feel very positive about them. But as Barbara said, you know, I have disagreements with some details.
Sure, and we'll give you a good chance.
let me go ahead and tell you just a few things that I like about them.
Oh, awesome.
While I'm talking about it. Aside from, you know, dealing with these problem issues, you know, I like the fact that obviously historians were involved in writing these. Mm-hmm. And, you know, there's historical craft shown, like in how how footnotes are used, and so on. And in fact, there's a little sentence at the bottom. We used the work of some historians in doing this. And, you know, I think that's really good that you have some of the critical insights of historians involved in these.
Historians that in many ways kind of got in trouble, at least some of the ones that are cited, like yourself, that, you know, you were sort of really walking a tightrope that made life a little difficult for you, weren't you, you know, just 15, 20 years ago?
Yeah, but of course, I wasn't involved in writing or editing.
Right. But I'm just saying the fact that they're using historical research and research on topics that were pretty taboo to even start approaching
Yeah,
20, 30
and
years
I like
ago.
The fact that they can put books by liberals like me and B. Carmen Hardy in the footnotes.
Right.
Of course,
nice.
We're not the main people cited. We're kind of just cited on ancillary issues, you know, and Brian's book is cited much more, you know, but just the fact that our names are in there is really remarkable. So
nice. Well, keep going if there were any more. I kind of interrupt you in the middle of
it. No, that's basically it. Those are some of the, you know, really impressive reasons why I think these are a step forward, at the same time that I disagree with some, you know, details in them.
Right. Yeah, there was a nice quote from Patrick Mason, who's at Claremont, for those who don't know, the Hunter Chair at Claremont, and I believe it was in the Deseret News article about it, and he just basically says, you know, with these gospel topics in general, and especially with this one, we're seeing a day where scholarship is being more openly embraced by the church, or at least, you know, it's less taboo, less suspect, so I think that's a general good thing beyond it. Brian, you thrilled that these things came out and all the big issues were, at least, I won't say all because I don't know if you feel like they all were, but a lot of the big issues were at least talked about?
Well, I think it's remarkable in a number of ways. If we look at the history of the church's official statements dealing with polygamy since the manifesto, and I'm talking about the entire 20th century, we really find almost nothing. There's one little snippet here when we talk about Utah history. There's nothing referred to of Nauvoo polygamy in any official publication until the Encyclopedia of Mormonism, when it's addressed there. And then we find the next big leap, I think, and maybe Todd or Barbara, if I'm missing something, just let me know. But when they came out in 2011 with Volume 2 of the journals of Joseph Smith, for the Joseph Smith Papers Project, that introductory essay was like 30 pages long, and I reviewed it for the Journal of Mormon History, and it was the first time the word polyandry, I think, had ever been used in an official publication, and we were all just amazed at all of this, and now we find this essay that just came out goes way beyond the introductory essay in that book. So the church has just made huge leaps after decades of silence on this subject, Dan. I think it's a huge addition and a positive step.
Awesome. Thanks. Now, are there any disclaimers that anybody needs to make? Were any of you, Todd, you already said you weren't consulted particularly in this. Did Barbara or you or Brian read early versions, or were you kind of on a team that was sending anything in?
No, I was not consulted. I didn't participate in any way.
Brian?
Yeah, yes, I did read an early version. It wasn't as good as the one that's out. I made a number of recommendations, some of which they took and some of which they didn't. So,
but you weren't really on the team that they convened to, you know, put this together.
No, I saw an early version and made a lot of suggestions and that's all.
And some of them got in there. Apparently, if it's better, right?
Well, actually, I don't know that it's better because of my suggestions. I just know that when I read the earlier version, I wasn't as impressed. I'm quite positive on the way it's turned out. But we'll be able to see what Todd thinks. I'm interested in that. So.
Yeah. Well, I really thought, Todd, we'd turn to you first. So again, an alert to the listeners. I kind of, rather than, you know, rather than this pure conversation that, you know, Mormon Matters often is I think we kind of agreed that in order to keep this under a reasonable time limit, I'm just going to give everybody a chance to kind of, you know, throw out their main comments kind of in a big chunk all at once. I'll ask them questions. Others can come in and just say, Todd, when it's my turn, I'm going to challenge that statement. Or, you know, we'll kind of keep our discussion to just short things other than the person who's who's speaking first, you know, when it's their turn. And then we can kind of everybody's going to be taking notes on each other's and address as we go. But, Todd, I thought I'd turn to you first because your expertise and at least your main writing has been on the Nauvoo period, and that's the first of the three major chunks. For those who aren't aware, what happened on the website is there's one essay that's maybe like prints out at about three pages, and then it, for each section it says, if you'd like to learn more about the early origins of it, click here. Same thing of how it was practiced in Utah, click here. Same thing for the end of polygamy, the manifesto, etc., click here. And so we're going to kind of just stipulate that there's that major essay, and you're certainly welcome to make any comments you want about that framing one. But Todd, I thought since your period is Joseph Smith and his wives, Nauvoo, Kirtland, etc., I just turn you loose if you wouldn't mind just taking us through whatever bullet points or whatever you have to raise.
Okay. Let me say at the beginning that in my book, I took each of these women from their birth to death, and kind of in the middle of that is Nauvoo. But then I kept with them into Utah, wherever they went. And, of course, looked at their childhood, if we had that, sometimes in Kirtland, sometimes in other places. And after I wrote In Sacred Loneliness, I edited the diaries of Helen Mar Whitney, who was one of the wives of Joseph Smith. And she was the one
She's famous in this essay. Right.
She was the one who was married when married Joseph Smith when she was 14 years old. But I looked at her diaries are from her later life in Salt Lake City. You know, very fascinating diaries from a later period. So that's very much a later period. And my last book has been on, I kind of co-edited a book on Mormons in Missouri. And my last book is a book, a biography of Jacob Hamblin. But part of the reason I'm telling you all this is because I have not been working on Nauvoo polygamy for, how long has it been, you know?
Well,
a decade,
17
and a half,
years,
something like
okay,
that. And so, you know, a lot of the details will not be as fresh in my mind as they are in Brian's mind, and I think he's still working hard on it right now. And he has also looked at some sources in the church archives that I did not see. So I'm just saying that if we get into some of the details, I, you know, some of them won't be as fresh in my mind. Okay. However, let me just say, I told you all, I mentioned, you know, my very positive reactions to these articles. And, however, as I said, I do disagree with some of the details, and that's kind of inevitable when you have two historians, you know, talk about the same issue. You know, they often they will disagree. And Brian and I disagree on some important elements of Nauvoo polygamy and Joseph Smith polygamy. So aside from that, I would like to also talk a little bit about problems with the format of these articles, okay? But just very briefly, these articles were very influenced by Brian Hale's, you know, three-volume work. You know, and I think it's cited eight times. And as he said, he was involved in editing it. And one of my friends said, it's basically a condensation of Brian Hale's three books, you know. And I thought that was funny, you know, and an overstatement, but they were very much influenced by Brian's book. And I feel positive about Brian's books, you know, but as I say, and as, you know, he knows, because we've talked about this at length, you know, I disagree with him on some of his interpretations, and especially on his interpretation of polyandry. And his view, if I understand it correctly, is that the polyandry, in other words, when a woman was married to Joseph Smith and what I call a first husband at the same time, Brian's theory is that these were marriages for eternity only, and there was no sexuality involved. And I believe that, you know, as a explanation for all of Joseph Smith's polyandry, this, you know, I don't find the evidence convincing for that. Okay, and since the Kirtland and Nauvoo article really depended on Brian, you know, because I disagree with Brian, obviously I disagree with that part of those essays. And then there's lots of little details that you might think aren't as important, like, just as an example, they talk about Fanny Elger, who was married in Kirtland to Joseph Smith in the earlier mid-1830s, depending on how you date it. And then they say Joseph Smith set polygamy aside. And I date one of Joseph Smith's wives in 1838. And in the Andrew Jensen papers, there's supporting evidence for that. One of the wives of Brigham Young also dated her, you know, so there's really good supporting evidence on that. You know, that's just an example of a small detail. But there's lots of small details like that. As far as the problems with the format of these articles, one of the obvious ones is they're really small. You know, they're dealing with very complex subjects, and they're very short. And so there's a lot of nuance that is left out. Okay, and so, in other words, possible, you know, alternative explanations are left out. And, you know, if it was a 30-page article, you'd expect them to discuss some of these alternative explanations. But in a small article like this was, you don't have these. And, you know, I think,
just a question. If you were to chase the footnotes, would you see that complexity in the alternatives, or are they only citing things that would pretty much agree with the lack of complexity that it's showing?
Well, as I say, they cited Brian 8 times, and they cited me just as for the quantity of marriages. And so, you know, they're very... They're very influenced by Brian's book, which is fine and understandable.
But Brian does at least talk about this. Are you trying to describe it places? Here's where the debates are.
And they go into Brian's book, obviously, and they'll get back and forth.
Okay, well, good. That's what I wanted to say.
Yeah.
Yeah. Okay. In Brian's footnotes rather than his body.
Okay. Oh, yeah, in the body, too. Yeah.
Okay. All right. Thanks.
Okay. But in the articles themselves, you don't have those alternate explanations. Okay. Another problem with this format is, you know, it's like, on the one hand, it's an official church statement, and on the other hand, it's a historical article. And the way I understand history is, it's kind of a dialogue. You go to the evidence, you know, and you work out how you think the story is from the evidence, and then you publish it, and then other people react to it. And it's a dialogue. And it you know, I think it's kind of uncomfortable for a church publication to, you know, to want to enter into this dialogue in this way, because, you know, it's a rough back and forth in historical dialoguing. You know, it would have been, in some ways, it would have been better if they would have had a specific author authoring one of these articles, and say, publish it under that author's name, you know. And one of the things that in regular history, you know, that the church is trying to, with these articles, engage in, one of the things that's very important is you have to show your evidence. So I think the church really has an obligation to show the evidence that it has cited, you know, and the evidence that is cited in Brian's book. And, you know, and the church archives has made great strides in doing this, but I still think there's some things that are not available that are cited in these articles.
Yeah, somebody brought up the George Buchanan diaries as one of the main ones.
Yeah, I think there's a lot, especially in the post-manifesto polygamy article, and so Barbara can talk about that. Is the Jensen, Brian, is the Jensen collection open yet?
You know, I'm not exactly sure what they're telling people down there, but I don't know that we have full transcripts, and Don Bradley has received high-resolution copies of all 18 documents and has received permission to publish them. If we could just light a fire under Don Bradley, we'd have those. And actually, I know he's working on it, and I'm hoping next year it'll be published. So I hope they're letting people see them, but the transcripts they can get from me or if they look for them. So.
Okay, so you're willing to share them with people, huh?
Well, yeah, and on that topic, my next project is to upload all of my archives, everything that I have collected, to a website so people can download everything. Now, there's a couple of things that when I got them from different repositories, they said you can't reproduce it, obviously, but those aren't significant. But I'll have everything up there, all the transcripts, everything Don Bradley got me, and hopefully within the next 6 months, it's mainly putting the catalog part of it together. Everything's already digitized. So if people want to know what I was looking at when I wrote the three volumes, they'll have equal access to virtually everything. And I'm excited about that.
Fantastic.
Okay, that's enough for me for the time being.
So when you're looking at this, you're basically saying we're not seeing the dialogue. We're seeing a church making a statement rather than really engaging in history.
Well, no, it's like I'm just wondering if they will be willing to enter the dialogue after they've started out. You know, like a book or an article that you put out there, you know, it's part of a dialogue answering something that went before, and it's inviting dialogue, you know, critical, positive, you know, from someone else. So I think if they publish it as an official publication, it might be uncomfortable for them to look at the dialogue that's going to come, you know, the serious historical dialogue that's going to answer it.
And a committee or a, I don't know if I call this clearly is a group document, and clearly some of the members, and I'm sure some of the influential members here, are not historians because they're ecclesiastical leaders that had to weigh in on this. So I was kind of trying to interrupt you a little bit when you mentioned Helen Mar Kimball. She's kind of famous for this one because instead of calling her a 14-year-old, Joseph married her when she was a few months shy of being 15. I have to laugh and think, I bet that was somebody just saying, is there a nicer way to kind of say that she was closer to 15 than 14, you know? Okay. So little things like that. So it would be hard for a committee to really engage in this dialogue, right? That's what your point was by having a particular author.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Interesting. Well, I appreciate that as a good intro and overview, and we'll certainly come back to you for more details later. Brian, do you want to kind of do the same thing as Todd, which is, you know, places that, you know, trouble you or excite you?
Well, I kind of feel like I should respond a little bit briefly to what Todd said about the polyandry. And actually, Todd and I have exchanged a bunch of emails on this, and what I think the essay handles polyandry much the way I believe that it should, but I should clarify for Todd that I don't believe it was one process. There were 14 women with legal husbands. I believe there were two processes going on there, and I don't know that Dan wants to get into those details, but to represent them all as eternity-only ceilings would be to misrepresent my position on three of them. And the interesting thing, though, I thought in the essay is that they actually hedge. It's footnote 30 discusses, or it leaves the door open for the possibility that maybe there was full polyandry. I mean, it argues heavily against it, but to me, it's something that isn't Brian Hale's, because I painted myself into a corner. If they find evidence of full sexual polyandry in any of Joseph's marriages, then I'm going to have to eat some words and rewrite. And that they don't do this. They say there is no evidence that Joseph Smith Ceilings functioned in full polyandry. I'm paraphrasing there. And much evidence works against this view. See, that's a hedge. They're not willing to close the door like I am on this topic. And I don't want to argue with Todd. There's if somebody's really interested in polyandry, I recommend they go to my website, and I should plug that here, Dan, if that's okay. It's josephsmithspolygamy.org. And if you go over to the dialogue section, there's a Hales Quinn button, and you can download Mike Quinn's 130-page document where he brings together every possible evidence supporting the idea of polyandry. And then please download my response to that. And then once somebody does and reads those two documents, you pretty well got everything out there that possibly could be used to promote or to contradict that idea. They become something of an expert. And if somebody after that point still believes Joseph practiced polyandry, well, I'm not going to argue with them. I'm okay with people disagreeing with me on it, but we need to make sure that we have all of the evidences in front of us. I think that's really important. And Todd mentioned Harriet Cook's testimony about Lucinda Pendleton, and there's actually evidence in the Andrew Jensen papers that contradicts that as well, Todd. I'm not sure if you knew that. So there's no slam dunk on another plural marriage between Fanny Alger and Louisa Beeman in Nauvoo, at least as we look at all of the evidence. So let me say one other thing. In the three volumes, I tried to put every known document, or at least reference it, dealing with this topic that anybody has ever mentioned. And I bet nobody has spent as many hours in Todd Compton's book as Brian Hales. And I mean, Todd pushed the can down the road so far, did a magnificent job with all of his research. And like I say, I've gone through that book. If you saw my copy of your book, Todd, you would be amazed at all the marks in it, in every page almost. So the point is that if they have used my three volumes to build this essay, and if my three volumes has all of the evidence in there, then really all we're saying is that we don't like Brian's interpretations, because the writers of the essay apparently agreed with Brian on the interpretations of all of the evidences. Now, I'm sorry to do so much talking. I would just add that we have found one evidence of another possible wife, or at least plural, a proposal by Joseph Johnston. I heard about it at the John Whitmer Historical Association meeting last month, and I'm really excited about it. But I can tell you there's at least one bit of evidence on one additional woman that isn't in the book, and I wish it were.
Okay, good. So when you look at this statement, especially they're focusing right now on the early, you know, the Kirtland and Nauvoo period here, were there any interpretations that you either didn't agree with, or would it just be that would be helpful for our listeners to know that even though the statement says this, there's clearly open debates in this area, and you know, in all fairness, we need to let people know, you know, this is an active debate going along among scholars.
Well, I've actually numbered the paragraphs in preparation for this.
Oh, nice.
But in the 21st one, it explains polyandry possibly as just an attempt to create an eternal bond or link. That's been promoted by different authors. I don't find evidence for that as we look at the evidence for the relationships. They all just seem to be plural marriages to me. And that's probably the only thing I would take issue with, really. I don't know what Todd thinks.
Oh, well, as I said before, I disagree with this idea of, in an unnuanced way, just kind of imply that all of the polyandrous marriages were marriages for eternity only and did not include sexuality. You know, because as you say, there were 14 different women, and I don't think, you know, I think that might cover the Ruth Sayers situation based on, you know, evidence in the Jensen book that you've reproduced in your book, you know, but I don't find those same dynamics with the other women. So, you know, and it would be nice if, you know, in the footnotes, they said other scholars have other interpretations, you know, in this area. In
right. Yeah. That's, I would love that too. And that's kind of what I hope that this podcast is helping with. There are debates, and we'll note those. We can't settle them.
And one woman who's not mentioned, and again, this is part of their short articles, you know. But in this short article, one woman who isn't mentioned is Sylvia Sessions Lyon, and of course, you've written at length about her situation, but of course, she doesn't fit in with the idea of eternity only with no sexuality at all. And you have your own theory on what went on with that. But it's totally left out of these small articles. And you can say, you know, they're small articles, I can't deal with everything, you know, but other people might come along and say, oh, they left off something that was very important, that went against their main point of view here.
Yeah.
Dan, let me add one thing.
But of course, if they go to your book, they will read about it at length.
and like you just said, your tables and stuff that are at your website. Yeah, I've seen your tables. So go for it. Keep going.
Well, Brian, on the topic of polyandry, there's you know, virtually everybody was writing that it happened up until my voice came out. And the one thing that none of these proponents have done is try to contextualize this alleged behavior theologically. I mean, Joseph Smith taught about eternal marriage, and every reference we have from him and every other Nauvoo polygamist is that polyandry would have been adultery. And people will say, well, so what? Joseph was an adulterer. You know, that's their position. But then you've got to explain, well, how come everybody just sat back and dealt with it? So anyway, the message here is if somebody wants to say he did it, they probably ought to try to contextualize it within his teachings and the actions of the individuals who knew about it. And there were dozens. And that's something that just hasn't happened. And Michael Quinn and his 130-page treatise doesn't even attempt it either. So that's left for the proponents to do.
I thought I contextualize it theologically, but evidently you didn't think so.
Well, you only had a few paragraphs. You're talking about in the introductory chapter.
Throughout the book in some way, especially in Mary Elizabeth Rollins Leitner, because in her autobiography she talked about how Joseph Smith explained that kind of marriage to her, you know, and talking about how she felt they were chosen to marry each other from the preexistence. It was connected with the preexistence and the theology of eternal priesthood marriages taking precedence over earthly marriages, just like, you know, Mormon baptisms take precedence over baptisms not performed by Mormon priests.
Right.
You know,
right.
And obviously you may not think that's enough, but it wasn't like it was... I left it totally uncontextualized.
Yeah,
Brian, defensive here, sorry.
let me do something here. Brian, my understanding of you is saying that if he's teaching theologically about eternal marriage and people are aware that he's going against his teachings, why isn't there more evidence that people are calling him a hypocrite? So the adultery thing's a different thing, but the hypocrisy on the teaching is what you're saying.
Or it is in conjunction with his teachings, and so where are they? He didn't teach Mary Elizabeth Rollins that sexual polyandry was okay. In fact, we have a lot from Mary Elizabeth Rollins on things leading up to her sealing to Joseph, and absolutely nothing about her relationship with him after they were sealed, suggesting to me that it was an eternity-only sealing. But anyway, yes, either he's this arch-hypocrite that nobody's reacting to, or this is part of his theology that nobody can find, and it contradicts several verses in Section 132 and Brigham Young's teachings and a whole host of others. So, but
okay.
Anyway.
Thank you. Barbara, let's have you jump in. I know most of your writing and stuff is in the Post Manifesto, but I'd love you to react to that first plural marriage in Kirtland and Nauvoo article.
Sure. Yeah, you asked Brian and Todd to share their overall impressions of the essays, and so I wanted to share my impression. After I read them, I came away from it feeling like these were written by a committee of men.
Okay, good.
Clearly, a lot of men were involved in this. I don't know if any women were involved or any women participated or not. Some women scholars were cited. But again, I just came away with that impression, feeling like these were written by men, for men, and about men. Ironically, even though that most of the people that participated in polygamy were women. And as I shared that opinion with different friends, most of the women I shared that opinion with said, that's exactly how I felt. If you look, go through the essays and look, very few women are mentioned by name, whereas we have a lot of men mentioned by name. And then it's been interesting to me that men continue to frame the conversation about even these essays on polygamy. For example, Dan, you mentioned the Deseret News article that came out today. Well, it was written by a man, and he interviewed two male scholars on their opinion. And not to take anything away from the scholars who were interviewed, because I respect them. They're fabulous Mormon historians. Why on earth was not a single woman asked to weigh in on what these essays meant to her? And I also want to acknowledge that these essays have created a lot of pain for a lot of people, and especially women. I've known about the issues that are brought up in these essays since I was a little girl. I knew that my ancestors practiced polygamy, and I've learned about more and more about polygamy as I've grown older and become a scholar of Mormon history. And it's, as a woman, it's incredibly painful to learn about these experiences and to read the voices of the women who practice polygamy. For example, Helen Mar Kimball Whitney, reading her writings about what that was like for her when her father, Heber C. Kimball, came to her and said, "I'd like you to marry Joseph Smith polygamously. You've got 24 hours to make your decision. These things you've been hearing are not just nasty rumors. Yes, polygamy is going on in Nauvoo. And not only that, but I've married another woman you don't know about yet a few months ago." And then to say, "You've got 24 hours to make your decision, and our family's eternal salvation rides on your accepting this principle." And she describes the agony she goes through that night as she makes her decision, and the agony she goes through as she lives this principle. At the end of her life, of course, she defends polygamy, saying that it's something that we have to do in order to enter into God's highest degree of the celestial kingdom. But she still says it was an incredibly painful experience for her. Where are those kinds of voices? Why aren't we hearing those kinds of experiences of the women who lived in polygamy? I'd like to hear more from women about how they feel about these things, more from female scholars as well as just women in general. I also want to acknowledge that so a lot of women...
So quick, let me stop you there. We don't know that there weren't women on this, but clearly we're thinking the decision makers of who decides to put this on LDS.org is there. Can you see, as say you had been on the committee, can you see working those types of agonizing, you know, into the, could it be a few paragraphs within this, or is this just, you know, or this is a general comment about this subject, which is, it is so painful. I don't know a single, like I kind of mentioned there, I was a little bit with a laugh in my voice early on. Nobody really likes talking about this stuff. I mean, Todd and Brian and so many people have worn out their lives studying it, but I don't know that anybody really enjoys, you know, this topic. It's terrible. It's a tragedy. If God commanded it, then I'm ticked at God, you know. If Joseph Smith and the whole angel with the flaming sword and all that stuff was purely made up from Joseph Smith, then I want to smack him. If it's somewhere in between where I can grant him, you know, some sort of confusion on the subject, that's where I've just had to land, but I'm not at all at peace. So no one, I think, is at peace with the practice of polygamy. But could you have worked that kind of stuff into these essays, given the nature of, you know, LDS.org?
I do think if, and again, I don't know exactly who was involved in producing them. It just reads to me and other women like it was a committee of men. I do think those kinds of issues could have been worked in more throughout the essays, and perhaps they still can be. I'm hoping that these aren't the end-all be-all, but we can continue to add to them. And I'd like to hear more of the women's voices and more of an acknowledgement, too. I think it, in the three essays, it says once that this was painful for people. It says several times that this was difficult, that it required a lot of faith, that it was challenging. But I really think we need to acknowledge the negative repercussions of polygamy and the painful part. And I think being willing to acknowledge that will make these essays less painful for the people who read them. So
I agree.
Again, I think these essays are painful for two reasons. First, a lot of women and men, as you point out, and I don't want to say it's only women who are feeling pain, but a lot of people who are not scholars in Mormon history, this is the first time they're hearing about polyandry. This is the first time they're hearing about a 14-year-old bride of Joseph Smith. This is the first time they're learning about all of these things. And so that's painful for them. And then also, I think, again, the tone, I came away from it kind of feeling like, okay, this happened. It was difficult, but you know, it's all okay. It, you know, polygamy wasn't that bad. It's a good thing. And so I think that kind of compounds the pain people are feeling like it's not being fully acknowledging just all of the negative repercussions that also existed along with the positive ones that are mentioned. There's wiggle language that is used that I think people are getting caught up in. Like, why not just say Helen Mar Kimball was 14? It's so odd to say several months shy of her 15th birthday. Do we think, did the writer of that think we wouldn't figure out that she was actually 14? Is 15 any better? Does 15 really sound any better than 14? Just say she's 14. And then saying like the men who were involved in the polyandrous relationships, that there was, the language used is there were virtually no complaints from them. Well, what's hidden in that word virtually? I'm not a scholar of Nauvoo polygamy, but I've read enough to know. I've read accounts from the men involved in those polyandrous situations that I've heard that there was a lot of pain for them too. Why do we just kind of rule that out and then put in the wiggle word virtually? Calling post-manifesto marriages that were illegal, calling them civil disobedience, as the essays do, again, I think is a euphemism. Just say it was breaking the law rather than calling it civil disobedience. Not acknowledging that polygamy was illegal in Mexico and Canada other than in a footnote. It's those kinds of things that people are getting stuck in and saying, ugh, they're not being fully forthcoming, that if we could just address those issues and shine more sunshine on them, I think the essays would be more positively received.
Yeah, and I wonder if those were in there and got taken out. And part of the evidence for that is almost what bothers me more than anything else about these essays is they almost all begin with statements that say, God's law is one man, one woman. This is the Book of Mormon law. This is the, you know, this is it. And there's just this exceptional time here, which sounds to me like that wouldn't be historians weighing in there. That would be the ecclesiastical voices on these things that say, no matter what, as we talk about this, we want everyone to know what our policies are today. And we want them to think that these have always been God's, you know, wishes and whatnot too, with these exceptional times. And so I guess that's what I'm saying is, like, when they throw it to a footnote or they throw the word virtually in there, do you believe it's because of the ecclesiastical folks rather than the historians? Or, for instance, if Todd's right and so much was them agreeing with Brian's work, Brian, or Barbara, you can say whether you think Brian does and Brian can defend himself or not. Does Brian use those kinds of wiggle words, or does he at least take on the issue so something else is going on, you know, with these wiggle words getting in there?
Well, Brian should speak to that, but I think sometimes Brian's interpretations seek to solely just defend Joseph Smith rather than just looking at the hard facts. Brian has done a prodigious amount of research over the years, and I think there's, as he said, there's no one that knows more about these facts than Brian Hales. I just disagree sometimes with Brian and his interpretation, but that's what historians do, right, Brian?
Yeah. I've been called an apologist, and I've had very good people that I respect disagree with me on the interpretations that I've chosen, but I still think that they're the best interpretations based on all of the evidence. And if we can get all of the evidence out there, I think that people will be less apt to accuse me of these things, but that remains to be seen.
Yeah. Yeah. Good comment. Now, I guess what I was going to say on that, Lindsay Hanson Park brought it up on a podcast that she was part of with John DeLynn over at Mormon Stories. And she did mention what I think you were sort of saying there, Barbara, that it does seem like whenever they can, these essays are going to privilege Joseph Smith is still a prophet. You know, he's not a fallen prophet through these things. You know, anything that you see that's weird and stuff like that have to do with difficulties of, you know, obeying either God's command or, you know, negotiating with his wife, Emma, who didn't support all these different things and stuff like that. So in other words, at every chance it's privileging Joseph Smith's reputation over complexity. Mm. Is that a good way of phrasing what you're kind of getting at there?
Yeah, I would say, I again, I'd love to see these articles be more nuanced. And they do point out positive things, positive results of polygamy, which I saw in my research in the families that I study, no doubt. But again, just more nuanced. And I really like what my advisor at the University of Utah, Bob Goldberg, said, as historians, we should seek to not promote faith, not seek to destroy faith, but seek to understand faith. And I'd like to see more of an effort to understand the faith that shaped us rather than to defend it. But again, it's the church's website. I mean,
It's LDS.org. I was about to say that.
It's not a strictly historical venue. So it's just tough. It's just walking a hard line.
For sure. They're in a tough position. They know they need to get this out, but they're obviously not promoting these things. I think they would just as soon have anybody who, you know, is either just not even thought hard about polygamy, just continue to not think hard about it and never discover these. Right. That would be their druthers. But on the other hand, they needed to bring stuff out.
Yeah, I think, and the church is obviously trying to serve its members with these essays. A lot of members have questions about these difficult, challenging issues in our past, and so it wants to serve those members as best it can, but at the same time, it's trying to hurt as few people as possible, or cause the least amount of pain for people as possible. And it's a hard line to try and do both at the same time. But I do think that it would actually cause less pain for people who are reading about this and learning about at the same time to acknowledge that, you know, this was really painful, particularly for women, and acknowledge that negative, acknowledge those negative repercussions as well as the positive ones.
Nice. Todd and Brian, do you agree with Barbara that those kinds of things really could have been worked into an LDS.org piece?
I totally agree. And part of what Barbara is talking about, I think, is part of the issue is that they're very short. You know, it's like you can't be that nuanced with something that's very short. But again, it's partially because they're published on the church website, and they're going to be very supportive of church views. And of course, you know, you've got the general authorities looking over their shoulders. You know, there's historians involved, but you've also got church leaders.
Guess who wins the final?
And so I think that would be very difficult, you know, to write his history that way.
Yeah, very difficult.
Yeah, you know you're going to be trumped by the ecclesiastical authority over the historical.
I think one of the great things is that so much good history was able to be put in these articles, you know.
Awesome.
At the same time, I agree with Barbara that, you know, there's a lot that was negative that I think should be in there that would make them stronger if we admitted, you know, that there was tragedy in polygamy, and sometimes polygamists didn't practice it correctly, especially men, and sometimes church leaders. And, you know, again, I think that For me, it's like this is an important first step, but it isn't the final step.
Right. Right. And won't it be interesting, Barbara, you left that door open, if these things do grow and if new iterations show up, I hope they'll announce that there's been some changes, or is it just going to have to be people, you know, doing the side-by-side comparisons through the years to see if they do grow and add? Brian, do you agree that, you know, with the, even on a churchlds.org, these would have been stronger to just talk about the exceptions to the more positive view right there?
You know, let me say a couple of things. I think that church leaders are in a tough spot when it comes to polygamy, because if you think about it, polygamy expands a man's emotional and sexual opportunities as a husband, as it simultaneously fragments a woman's emotional and sexual opportunities as a wife.
That's right.
As a practice on earth, it is sexist and it's unfair. And there's just no way to spin it in a way that's positive. I mean, some of the women in the 1880s, and Todd, I'm sure, wrote about some of this in the bios, they're out there trying to say this is really a good thing and we really love it. But I don't know that I believe them. We've got some private comments that are exactly the opposite. It's a tough thing to try to defend. So I don't blame the brethren for not maybe trying to contextualize it that way, because it's just a depressing practice. And I don't like studying the Utah period of polygamy because it just makes me depressed. And there's almost no redeeming interactions. There's a few, obviously, but it's a tough one. But let me say this also for Barbara. There's at least, and maybe this is way too little, but there's one whole paragraph where Lucy Walker talks about how her feelings were against it. And then they quote Zina talking about how she made the greatest sacrifice of her life to enter into it. So what I see is the writers, and again, I think they probably were men, though I do know that there were two women who were consulted on the polygamy topics generally, because they let that out when I was talking to them. So they were trying, and I think these two paragraphs are, and I didn't look through any more, but I think they were trying to show some sensitivity to the women who were involved. And again, maybe it's just not enough, but I do see some evidence of that.
Brian, I really, really appreciated how you said, you know, this is really depressing, and it's sexist, and it privileged men while it placed women into subjection, paraphrasing you there. I love how you said that, and I wish that these essays had done more of that, because I felt like they just sought to only put a positive spin on it. And again, there are positive things that came from polygamy, no doubt. But it's that positive only spin, minus the absence of acknowledging how sexist this was, that I think causes more pain, particularly for women, when they read these essays.
I hear you. I have to agree. You guys good with that?
Did I get what you were saying correctly? Did I summarize that accurately in your opinion?
Yeah, you reflected it very well. It's a tough one to sell. Polygamy is during mortality. And if they're going to be able to help women, especially to look at polygamy in any kind of a positive light, they're going to have to expand the discussion of eternal marriage and exaltation and continuation of the seeds. And basically a lot of things that we really don't know a lot about, but it's that hope that would make somebody say, okay, I'd rather be a polygamous wife in eternity than be single and separately without exaltation in my saved condition to all eternity, which is verse 17 of section 132. And that's the only way I think we can sell polygamy in a positive way here on earth, because it's a tough one. But I wanted to ask Todd, as you followed these biographies out and these women, did you find any of them that truly seemed to think that it was better than monogamy? Is there any of these wives that if you could have handed them a single husband that was all their own and without any kind of spiritual compromise, is there any of them that would have chosen polygamy, in your opinion?
that's kind of what if polygamy and what if history, which is always fun to do, you know, like what if Jacob Hamblin had been south during the Mountain Meadows Massacre?
Right.
And, you know, I'll answer it to say that they had very conflicted views of polygamy and Joseph Smith's polygamy. And I'm thinking of Emily Partridge, you know, and later in her life, she wrote quite a bit about it and how painful it was. And partially she blamed Emma Smith, you know, and I think partially it comes through in her writing. She blamed Joseph Smith. You know, he just shook their hands and said, "You've got to go. Emma says you have to go." And that was the end of their marriage. And, you know, and at the same time, she looked at Joseph Smith as a prophet, and she had a difficult marriage with her other husband, Brigham Young, you know, and yet she viewed him as a prophet too. So very, you know, very interesting but tragic, you know, conflicted views of her personal life as a wife and her view of polygamy as a doctrine. And I think it was Brian mentioned, you know, often sometimes in public they would be, you know, very much supportive of polygamy, and then in their private writings, you know, you find how difficult it was for them and how they had problems with it. And a lot, you find a lot of this in the post-manifesto polygamy women too, and you find that, you know, it was very, very difficult for the women especially, you know, because they were the ones who had to be wives in secret. The men could, you know, live as general authorities, and the women had to live in secret on the underground, and it was very, very difficult for them.
Right.
Do you agree?
Absolutely. Absolutely. Yeah. You know, while the men, their marriages to their first wives, and for first wives, their marriages were legal and therefore, quote unquote, legitimate. For second wives, it was very, very difficult because they had to, as you pointed out, Todd, live in secret. Many of them never even told their own family members that they had been married polygamously, and they kind of had to live this underground life.
And if they had a baby...
And then if they had a baby...
They couldn't say, this is a legitimate baby, you know?
Right, exactly.
And so sometimes you had local leaders wanting to excommunicate them.
Exactly. And this is a big issue with Mexico, is you have all of these faithful Latter-day Saints who move to Mexico because they believe that they are keeping the principle of polygamy alive in accordance with their church leaders' recommendations, and believing that they're making these incredible sacrifices so that they can be worthy to enter into the highest degree of the celestial kingdom. And then after the second manifesto, which we haven't talked about yet, but that appears in 1904, and then the Mexican Revolution in 1912, they come back into the United States. And here they are, these polygamous families, they're pariahs among their own monogamous counterparts back in the United States. And you have monogamous Latter-day Saints looking at these polygamous Latter-day Saints, and what they know is the 1890 manifesto. And so they think these folks that have continued to practice polygamy are horrible.
Yeah.
When in fact they've gone under approval and encouragement from their church leaders.
Yeah.
In Salt Lake City. So it's such a mess.
Yeah.
And well, I have a question for Barbara about this, if that's okay, Dan.
Sure. You didn't quite answer Brian's question earlier, but this is a fun discussion. No, well, I'll rephrase it, but go ahead and ask your question to Barbara, and then I'll remember it.
Barbara, one of the things I really liked about the article was on post-manifesto polygamy is it really named names of a lot of the apostles who were involved
right.
in manifest mm-hmm. polygamy. There's a list.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and often when they're talking about it, they say, oh, there's, you know, the bad guys, Taylor and Callie, who were kicked out of the Quorum of the Twelve, and
right.
one was excommunicated.
Mm-hmm.
But they put down a whole list of people, you know, like the sons of prophets, you know, like,
yep.
like Woodruff
mm-hmm.
and so on. Right. I really liked that. However, did it come through to you in that article that the First Presidency was authorizing these post-manifesto marriages?
Yeah, I agree with you, Todd. I really like that they listed those apostles who were performing plural marriages. I think the article just said that they authorized them, but in fact, some of these were performing plural marriages. So again, that's where it could have gone a little farther. And I just felt like it was a little bit soft on talking about how the first presidency authorized these marriages. I think that it could have come out more clearly, saying that
they kind of got close to it, didn't they?
Yeah, they kind of stepped around it, but again, I just wish it would be more forthcoming, more clear. Yeah.
And you wonder if it was in drafts and it just couldn't quite make the final cut.
Yeah,
so interesting. Well, Todd, the question that I thought Brian was asking, though, was, were there any stories out there? I guess he was talking about the 33 women that you wrote the biographies of, but he was just kind of saying, do we know any of them who really did genuinely seem to be happy in polygamy, in plural marriage, that in some ways, again, you can't play the what-if game, but that they truly were quite happy, and you don't see this public-private split from supporting it publicly, and you know, more than any wife in private would complain about her monogamous husband and, you know, the trials of her marriage, you know, that kind of thing.
You know, someone like Zina, Diantha Huntington, Jacobs, Smith Young.
Yeah, I remember her name.
You know, and I think she fit in pretty well with Brigham Young's plural family. If this is, I don't know if I'm answering your question, but Eliza R. Snow too. I think she fit in well with Brigham Young's plural family, and you know, the question is, at the end of the day, would they have preferred to marry someone monogamously?
Right.
You know, I don't know. I don't know if anyone asked them that. You know, and you'd have to ask privately.
Yeah. And then you add the layer in that a lot of them were, that did it was for the next life, or because this was a priesthood leader, a really,
right,
you know, high one up there. So that adds a layer to it too. So Brian, you asked that question. Did I do justice when I asked Todd to follow up on that question?
Yeah, you did great. And Todd, sorry about what ifs. I don't like what ifs either. I just didn't see a lot of real happy polygamous women in the brief studies that I've looked at during that period. I just don't prefer to look at it because I think it's kind of depressing. But
well, there were some, you know, I think there were some
cool
families where it worked out pretty well. And the husband tried to be very equal, and the wives, sometimes they were. They acted like sisters. They really loved each other, you know.
If I could chime in on that.
And
Todd's absolutely right. They're worse. I think polygamous marriages in a lot of ways are like monogamous marriages, in that you have a full spectrum of happiness on the marriage scale. So you have some polygamous marriages that actually did work out, and they lived very happily. Others, of course, not so happy, just like monogamous marriages. But in the families that I studied, I saw, as Todd mentioned, times when there were quote-unquote sister wives who got along fabulously. They were really good friends. And oftentimes those worked out because they and their husband were involved together in choosing who the next plural wife would be. And then this, and then the same people, a next wife wouldn't get along so well with that same wife who had gotten along with the second or third wife. So it's just, you just have this full spectrum. But in every case, I don't think anyone ever entered, at least in the people that I studied, entered into polygamy with the idea of this is going to be so much fun. This is fantastic. We love this. It was all, this is our spiritual duty. This is our spiritual obligation if we want to achieve the highest degree in the celestial kingdom. This is what we must do. And so we're going to follow God's command and do what we believe to be the right thing to do. But it was never, in my estimation, something that anyone really thought was going to be a fantastic way of living.
Nice. And I think the less women married, the greater the likelihood that it would be not problematic. In other words, if you have 10 wives and you have to divide your time, time and resources in 10 ways, it would be a lot more difficult. So if you have a family of two or three wives, it would be, you know, less problematic generally.
Yeah.
Right. Yeah. And the happier marriages I saw were like you mentioned, where there are just two wives or maybe three, but generally two.
Yeah. Now, you know, there was a couple of places that they talked about. Of course, there were lots of divorces. You could always divorce it if you were unhappy. And I don't know if this is the right word to call it anachronistic, but it, in some ways, it almost is like relying, it seemed to me, on today's kind of divorce, which is just, you know, I mean, always it's tragic when a family ends. You know, we don't want to minimize that. But in today's, you know, today's idea of divorce is, you know, this is often for the best, and this is often, you know, kind of just move on. When they kind of talk about the divorces were always available and many women did, you know, get out of these relationships, do you guys feel like there was a little fudge factor there by not really explaining how much more traumatic it would have been back then?
Yeah, that was one of the areas that I felt like, okay, it's great that they acknowledged that Brigham Young freely granted divorces to his people, which was a right that women in other contexts did not have at that time. But then it failed to mention how common, how many polygamous marriages ended in divorce. You see what I'm saying? So it mentions the positive side, but then doesn't go into the large number of women who divorced Brigham Young himself, for example, or other church leaders.
Okay, so the numbers were not acknowledged, but wasn't it so much, there were so many more factors involved in getting a divorce then in terms of like, what's your situation going to be now, that don't really translate to today's kind of how we think of divorce?
Dan, I think that's a really insightful comment. And I really dislike this defense of polygamy, you know, that, oh, they could get divorces, because often now and then divorces were really, really painful. And you would really not want to do it, you know, until you were absolutely forced to do it.
Right.
And back then, sometimes women in divorces, I mean, sometimes children were given to the father. So a woman might lose her children if she divorced.
Women, I don't think that they had any legal right to their children in the case of a divorce. I think the rights automatically went to the men. I'm not positive, but again, I saw that happen a lot in the families that I studied, that the children always went to the father. Women were kind of banished and they left.
I've seen some where they went to their mother, but there was the possibility they would go to the father. You know, so that would, you know, really cause any woman not to want a divorce.
Yeah.
If she had kids.
Well, guys, let's just quickly, the middle of the three essays, even when you click on it, it's the shortest, and it's the Utah period. And I want to bring up at least the one thing, you know, it talks about there's lots of different reasons, and we're not clear about all the reasons of why the Lord would command it. And they've already, in the Kirtland and Nauvoo one, we didn't really go into it, but they basically wanted to make the point that Joseph Smith was commanded. He was hesitant. He was dragging his feet. Finally, you get the angel with the sword. So they basically, the church is hanging its hat on God commanded it. So in this middle section one, they talk about, we don't know all the reasons, but one of them was to increase seed, to raise a paraisic generation. And indeed, it did have this effect. But then they don't really talk about the rest. But in some ways, Brian, the question to me is, if you're going to hang your hat too heavily on raising a righteous seed, then you would think that Joseph Smith would have sexual relations even with his polyandrous wives, too. Do you get that little rub there? Do you have a comment in that area? And then Barbara and Todd, please jump in on this idea of that they were kind of selling, I don't know, selling, that's a pejorative term, that they were, you know, kind of pushing as the main, what they think is the main reason for God commanding it.
Well, I appreciate being able to respond to that, Dan, because there's two different questions. There is, why does plural marriage need to be part of Joseph's theology, his global ideology? And I find in section 132, the four different reasons it needs to be included. One is, it's a restitution of all things, and this is verses 40 and 45.
And the essays do bring that up a bit, that is part of the restoration of all things.
The second one is that it's a special trial, that I did it all to prove you, and it's 53 or something. And this is one of the two reasons that they mention in the second essay, was that it was a specialized trial for them, and I believe that's accurate. The third reason is to multiply and replenish the earth. And that's verse 63. And then there's a fourth reason, and it's reflected in the essay, but not actively discussed. And I can tell you, I've gotten a lot of pushback from this, and I'm puzzling over why, because Joseph Smith asks a question about plurality of wives, and God suddenly starts talking about eternal marriage. So you got to scratch your head and say, okay, what does eternal marriage have to do with plurality of wives? And then we learn in verses 16 and 17 that every man, every woman has to have a spouse if they want to be exalted. And then we read on and we find out a plurality of wives is permitted and a plurality of husbands is adultery. And to me, the answer is real plain, and it's in verse 63. It is for the women's exaltation in the eternal world. It anticipates that there will be more worthy women, and that's why we have a plurality of wives, is that they can be sealed to husbands, which is necessary for exaltation. Now, those are the four reasons it needs to be included. We are only told one reason why God would ever command it. There may be other reasons, but the only reason it's commanded is to raise up seed. And, of course, that comes from Jacob 2 and 30. And whether there are other reasons or not, I believe that it's necessary in Joseph's theology, because everybody's got to be sealed. And that's why the eternity-only sealings are an important motif, because they fulfill this most important reason for plural marriage. And Todd may be rolling his eyes now, and I apologize, but I believe that it's all right there, very plainly taught in section 132. And that's part of the theology that I think goes into understanding not only polygamy, but the marriages to women with legal husbands.
Todd and Barbara, do you want to scream now out loud, or how do you want to react to Brian there?
Well, I'm glad you brought this up, Dan, because that was one of the contradictions that I felt existed in these essays was, kind of saying, well, Joseph Smith, he never had any offspring from his plural wives, but yet we have Jacob, too, as Brian mentioned, saying, well, the reason for polygamy is to raise up seed. Right. So if Joseph Smith wasn't having sexual relations with his plural wives, I mean, last time I checked, having seed involves sexual relations. So, right. There was that very confusing contradiction that comes out in the essays.
That's why Brian brings up the other three reasons that he found in 132.
Exactly. And then what about the contradiction? The other contradiction, Brian, you mentioned that a plurality of husbands is mentioned as adultery in D&C 132, but yet we have polyandry. We had women who had a plurality of husbands.
Well, in response to that,
Joseph Smith. So that confuses me too. If you want to answer that.
Well, I would argue that none of these women ever saw themselves as having two genuine husbands. And that's why I've stopped using the word polyandry, and I just talk about, did they actually have two husbands in the eyes of the church? And I believe the answer is no way, because it would have been adultery. And the issue about sexuality, I've documented sexuality in 12 of the marriages. It's on my website. You can read all the accounts. They're all plainly transcribed there. So I do believe that Joseph was trying to consummate these marriages, but he was living in a pretty tough time. And once Emma found out, she had spies out. I mean, there were lots of reasons for him to have trouble impregnating these women. And we do have, in my research, two children that were born, one to Olive Frost and one is Sylvia Session Lyon's daughter, Josephine. And Todd and I have alluded to that already, and possibly a third. So there actually is good evidence for some children. And they tucked that away in a footnote that we really don't know.
Yeah.
Right. Yeah. I'm glad that you point that out. What about, was it Sarah Ann Whitney? Who was sealed to Joseph and then later went through kind of a sham marriage to a husband?
Correct.
Didn't she consider herself as having two husbands, Joseph being one of them?
Well, good.
One was a sham marriage, though.
Yeah, go ahead. There was no conjugal relations by everybody's accounts. And Joseph C. Kingsbury later charged the church, I think, was it $5,000 or something for all of the care that he'd done for her? We don't know if John Taylor paid that or not. But
right. But she did have two husbands, though, whether, one publicly, this is my husband, that she acknowledged publicly, and then one secretly, who was Joseph.
But Brian, are you then saying that adultery is not having two husbands, or it's sleeping with two men? It's the sex part that is the adultery part. Is that what you're saying, Brian?
Well, again, a true husband is somebody you can have a family with, and we can haggle about definitions because I know Todd and I have got different definitions of marriage as well, but I don't see them as equal husbands. You know, I mean, yes, in an open kind of way, maybe they saw Joseph Kingsbury as the husband, but she did not see him as her husband in any genuine sense.
And that's quite different than most of the what I call polyandrous marriages, when there are 11 or 12 of them, something like that. And that the woman was married to a man legally and was living with him, and then married Joseph Smith by priesthood authority, and then continued living with what I call the first husband. And so Larry Foster, of course, the scholar Lawrence Foster, has, you know, strongly rejected the concept of, you know, the term polyandry, you know, and I think it's useful, you know, it's valid if you say they were different kinds of marriages. One was a legal marriage and one was a religious marriage. They were at the same time, you know, but they were different kinds of marriages. There were never two priesthood marriages at the same time that I know of.
Well, and I, as I read the New Everlasting...
With one man marrying two husbands.
Two wives.
One woman.
One woman marrying two husbands.
Yeah. But I read, and again, we only have some sketchy support for this, but Joseph is told that the New and Everlasting Covenant would cause all old covenants to be done away. So I theorize, and there is some other supportive evidence, that a woman who's then married in the New and Everlasting Covenant, that her old legal covenant would be done away. Now, we don't really have any evidence that that actually happened, but what it tells us is no woman could have two genuine husbands so far as the church was concerned.
No matter what the law said. Well, of course, the law wouldn't have recognized the Joseph part.
Right.
Interesting.
And again, I would say that, you know, I would think that the Sylvia Session Lyon case would be something that should be mentioned. You know, and again, you could say it's very short. They can't mention everything, but
that should have made it in. Okay.
Yeah. And, you know, you could use Brian's interpretation of it, you know, because he's
written. But at least lay it out.
Yeah.
Well, and I don't disagree with you, Todd, because I think she's the only child to grow to adulthood, certainly the only one we have good evidence for, and so mentioning her might not be a bad idea.
Yeah, you know, and it's interesting, Laurel Thatcher Ulrich, you know, who's writing on polygamy now, I heard her talk at MHA, and apparently she had the interpretation that Josephine Lyon was not the child of Joseph Smith. You know, she thinks it was like a family remembrance thing that wasn't true. So it'll be interesting to see what her argumentation for that is, because, you know, at this point, by the evidence I've seen, I accept her as a daughter of Joseph Smith. And again, our readers, you're just going to have to go to my book and Brian's book to read the whole story, you know, because we're leaving a lot out right here.
Yes.
Yeah, that's right.
Woohoo! I hope you guys sell a bunch. I'll link to them through my website. And please, everybody, click through from the Mormon Matters site. I get a small percentage. Not that I don't want you to buy them anyway, but that's one way to support the podcast, is to go through my Amazon link. Anyway, okay, let's just move forward a little bit, guys. Is there anything else in that middle, plural marriage and families in early Utah one that you just, like, say, boy, this is a wiggle room. This is. Are there any hot debates there that you think could have been avoided and should have been avoided?
Well, I think it's fantastic that this essay and the other one on post-manifesto polygamy acknowledges that the 1890 manifesto did not end polygamy, that it led to the end. So that's great to acknowledge that plural marriages continued to be contracted after 1890 with the authorization of the first presidency. But I wish it would have gone into more of, you know, there were a lot that continued.
Mm-hmm.
You know what I'm saying? So anyways, but I do want to give kudos for the fact that it does acknowledge that it only led to the end, but did not end polygamy as is common. I hear all the time, you know, the church discontinued the practice in 1890, which is just not true.
Yeah. So, and it was just those two bad apostles that were just going rogue. Yeah.
Yeah. No, not at all. Yeah. Not at all. It was authorized by the first presidency from Wilford Woodruff, George Buchanan, Joseph F. Smith. The article does point out that those marriages, approval for those marriages was extremely hard to achieve, and that is true. To get to authorization, it was difficult, but nevertheless, the first presidency did continue to authorize those plural marriages and authorized apostles and other men to perform them, most of them in Mexico.
But it does point out that some of them occurred in the United States, too.
Right. Some of, yeah, absolutely.
It was good that it had that in there.
Yeah, I agree with you, Todd. So kudos for those points.
Very good. So in the post-manifesto, Barbara, you kind of started us down there. Did you have other main points, especially any niggles with some of the, you know, oh, wish they did more, or their, boy, they sure took a minority opinion here and kind of made it the standard.
So I liked the fact that it pointed out the political factors that led to both the 1890 manifesto and then also what's colloquially called the 1904 second manifesto. But one criticism I would have is that while Wilford Woodruff did say he received a revelation before the 1890 manifesto, I've not seen any indication that the later manifesto, the second manifesto, came as a result of revelation as much as just a bowing to the political issues that were going on at the time, brought on by the Reed Smoot trials.
Well, and so, even if Woodruff said that it was a revelation for the 1890 original manifesto, it was never presented as a revelation, was it?
I think he pretty openly referred to it as a revelation.
Oh, did he? Okay.
The second manifesto?
I'm talking about the first one.
I never got the impression that a whole lot of people thought it was a thus saith the Lord as much as it was an announcement. No?
He says that after much prayer, he received a revelation of God and decided this is the way that the church needed to move forward. He acknowledged that. I don't know if it's specifically mentioned in the manifesto per se.
Okay, and the wording of the manifesto is not not a revelation the way you would say a section of the DNC is, you know.
Right.
Yeah. But yeah. Okay. Yeah. I came through a revelatory process.
Right.
This
yeah.
Decision.
It's definitely Woodruff's voice. It's not the Lord's voice.
Right. Okay. That's I guess what I was clarifying.
But he does say that he received it as a result of revelation.
Okay.
Received the authority to move forward in that direction.
And there's some footnotes in our publication on that.
Mm-hmm. You
know, okay.
In the Doctrine and Covenants.
Right. But with the 1904 manifesto, and I guess I should explain the difference, is in 1904 there was what was called a second manifesto, which basically just reaffirmed the first. Although it also said that any man practicing polygamy entering into a new plural marriage would be excommunicated from the church. But the difference is what happened afterwards. This time, after the 1904 manifesto, Joseph F. Smith makes it clear, even to the people in Mexico and Canada, that there will be no more plural marriages. That said, there were still some, a much smaller number, but there were still some that continued to be authorized after that point. But there was a huge a major decrease after 1904, if not a complete cessation. But Joseph F. Smith, he doesn't seem to say this is it and final and it will never be brought back again.
Right.
There's an interesting meeting in 1905. He goes down to Colonia Juarez and he speaks to a priesthood meeting of that stake. So basically these were all of the colonies in Mexico where Latter-day Saints were practicing polygamy after the manifesto and living. But he speaks to the men of the stake in a priesthood meeting, and he says, there are no plural marriages being performed at present in the church, in Mexico or anywhere else. Be true to your wives and your children that God has given you, for God will hold you responsible. But men cannot marry plural wives at present with my consent, nor the consent of the church. The church is on trial before the government of the United States, and we must be very careful. And so the trial he's referring to are the Smoot trials.
Right.
But that language to me seems to indicate he hasn't received a revelation saying, this is it, we really mean it, we're done, no more polygamy. It's just him saying, for now we're not going to continue to authorize these marriages, but we just need to be really careful.
And so, is any of that kind of nuance in this third section at all?
No.
Okay. Brian or Todd, did you read any of that sort of, that clearly even when he's issuing the second manifesto, he didn't really want to or he didn't think that this was going to be binding for long. It was just sort of a compromise.
Well, that's way out of my area.
Okay.
Though, obviously, it's really, really interesting. Let me just say more generally, an experience I had. There's a group study group called Miller Eccles in Southern California. And
right.
While I was there, someone came down and talked, and he gave the point of view that the polygamy in Mexico was not authorized. And in the audience was someone who was a descendant of one of those polygamists, and she was just furious, you know. So I think it's really important that, you know, that in these articles that they really explicitly say, you know, it was authorized by the first presidency. These were righteous people, you know, mm-hmm. and the people born, you know, were born to righteous families.
Mm-hmm.
Because if they don't, you know, this whole, you know, the people who are descendants will continue to be upset by people who kind of put them in a second class, you know.
Right.
Brian, anything that you'd want to add about just this? We'll turn back to Barbara for anything more she wants to say on this final essay, but anything that you want to say on the points that she's made so far about the 1904 not coming by revelation, and anything that, like, yeah, I could see that there was room for them to throw in some more things along the lines that she and Todd were talking about.
Well, one of the big things that I see that is absent from the third essay is a discussion of the sealing keys. Joseph Smith taught one person controlled those, and in Nauvoo, when somebody tried to seal without his permission, he told him he'd go to hell if he did it again. And then Brigham Young excommunicated a man who took plural wives without his permission. So he saw himself as the one man controlling the authority. John Taylor, though, with the underground, went ahead and let people kind of make local decisions and to make ceilings because he couldn't approve them all. And so there was this diffuse network where people could decide more or less on their own. And this continued after the 1890 manifesto. And it wasn't really reined in until 1904 when Joseph F. Smith came back from Washington. He could see that they had to stop because they weren't going to be able to keep these things secret, and he, as the one man holding the key, says, we're just not going to do this anymore, and he didn't. I really believe that he did not prospectively authorize any more plural marriage after April of 1904. There were a few that were done, some sincerely, that he later acknowledged and allowed, but they excommunicated the person who performed them. But that was where Joseph S. Smith had to try to rein in this network of diffuse people who thought they were authorized to perform these marriages. And it took several years, as Barbara kind of alluded to there. But the one thing that I was surprised in the third essay is it really didn't talk about the authority of the one man, because this diffuseness is what planted the seeds of the Mormon fundamentalist movement, because they just continued this right up into the 1920s with their own set of stories. And they're saying, we're just doing what those guys did between 1890 and 1904. And you can certainly see where that argument might be persuasive to some.
Right. And so you feel like the essay could have dealt with that more directly.
Right. Well, I'm surprised it didn't.
Yeah. Okay. And I'm in complete agreement with Brian on that. I think there's this confusion that results because there is no hard, fast line that's drawn. I mean, we talk about the 1890 and the 1904 manifestos drawing a hard, fast line, but in reality, there's a lot of fuzziness still and a lot of haziness and a lot of confusion. And I agree with Brian. That's why the fundamentalist groups continued, and they maintain today. My understanding is that they are just keeping alive what the prophets had directed them to do.
Yeah, seven guys were authorized, and most of the groups, you can see them right from those seven families.
Yeah, and I think that's another observation I wanted to make on these three essays is they are so positive about polygamy and so affirmative that this is doctrine that came from God, that they bring the church closer to the fundamentalist groups in which the church has been trying so desperately to distinguish itself.
Interesting.
For 20 years. You know, I mean, if I were reading these as a Mormon or as a non-Mormon, I might say, wow, actually, the LDS Church really isn't as distinct from these fundamentalist groups as it purports to mean. I'd love to hear what Brian thinks about that because of his family being involved with fundamentalism.
Well, I still deal with fundamentalists, and I have many good friends that are there, but they have no authority, and their marriages are not recognized according to DNC 132.18. I mean, it anticipates this very scenario, and you know, I feel bad because there's a lot of really good fundamentalists out there.
Okay. And so when you were talking earlier, so it sounds like in some ways your theology, Barbara's point is true in the sense that there is this theology that God really did grant the keys to one person. You're saying Joseph S. Smith was that person at this point. And so theologically, the idea that God really was behind polygamy, he really wanted it to be practiced, you're at least in agreement with that idea. And is Barbara, is that at least partly what you were saying, that moves the church a little bit closer to fundamentalists today?
I guess what I'm saying is just in it's so positive about these things, okay, about polygamy, and so affirming that this was church doctrine, that we move closer, I think, in seeming more similar to fundamentalists in our views. Again, I'm not saying that.
But it's the positivity. True. It's the positivity.
I'm not saying that is true, but I think that perception can be created by these essays.
Okay, cool. Now, Brian, my question then is more for you. You really, in your mind, God really did probably send that angel. God really did say, I want this restored at this time and things like that. Whereas I know I'm far more conflicted about the clarity of that call. And I don't know where Todd and I'm guessing where Todd and Brian are, or Todd and Barbara are. But Brian, for you, that has a ring with what the fundamentalists believe, that God really did command this, that there is an exaltation element to polygamy.
Well, yes and no. I think there will be some polygamists in the celestial kingdom because there will be more worthy women than men. And I know when I say that, people roll their eyes, but if you read section 132, it's predicted there, it's anticipated there. And the blessings of eternal marriage, of exaltation, of godhood, all of this comes not from polygamy. Polygamy was not Joseph's zenith doctrine, it was eternal marriage. I don't know if I could just maybe I'll kind of stop here. But Brigham Young said this about eternal marriage. He said it lays the foundation for worlds, for angels, and for the gods, for intelligent beings to be crowned with glory, immortality, and eternal lives. It is the thread which runs from the beginning to the end of the holy gospel of salvation, from eternity to eternity. End of quote. That's Brigham Young. And see, that's eternal marriage, not plural, but for all of the worthy women to gain that blessing, we need some people to have polygamous wives in eternity. And that's the theological reason for it as I see it. But if we aren't looking at that, and it's a lofty idea, all I can say is I agree with the bumper sticker that says the punishment for polygamy is two wives. It's just not something I would ever want to do. So,
I think you answered my question there. Barbara, Todd, do you want to jump in on that particular? I mean, I don't want to out you guys with your own, you know, views on, you know, the clarity of God really was behind this or not.
I think it's a really difficult issue for our present day church. On the one hand, they really want to distance themselves from polygamy. Mm-hmm. And on the other hand, they want to portray 19th century polygamy as a wonderful thing.
Mm-hmm.
You know? So it's, you know, and you can see some of these tensions in these articles.
Yeah.
Todd expresses my view that I was mentioning earlier on this. I think speaking to Brian's last comments, I think this is where Brian receives a lot of his criticism, is saying, oh, there's going to be more women in the celestial kingdom than men. That's where you get beyond historical analysis and you're just sharing personal beliefs. And and that's where I think the problems in his interpretation come.
And isn't there that...
With all due respect, Brian.
Yeah. And there was that kind of funny but somewhat serious piece in Dialogue years ago about all the children who die before they're 8, and it's a higher number of women, you know, of girls that die than men, you know, in the before age 8. And somebody was basically trying to say that you can't even, you know, make those numbers work, that there'd be more righteous men than women, or righteous women than men.
Yeah,
actually,
you're getting beyond historical
interpretation
there.
Yeah.
Well, but there are statements that I think are being ignored here. But I'm going to keep pushing it, Barbara, and eventually I think we'll win this one, because if you'll read the entire section, it's anticipated there very plainly. It surprises me at the pushback. But you're right. I'm highly criticized by it, and I do talk about that in my Volume 3, but I won't go into that here.
No, and Brian, I'm so glad that you're out there reminding so many of us that, you know, you know, we can make up our decisions, but if we tend to believe, if we want to claim, you know, Section 132 as a revelation from God, and you're basically reminding us that this is some of the stuff that it says in there, where, you know, guys like me can, you know, I can forget to even entertain that idea, you know, without voices like you. So I'm thrilled to have you, you know, on this call, as well as doing the work that you're doing and being so public. So thank you.
You're very kind.
Brian? Don't you agree, though, that throughout the 19th century, a lot of leaders said that polygamy was absolutely necessary to reach the highest salvation?
Yes. Mm-hmm.
And then later, you know, after the turn of the century, I think Talmage was one of the first people who started saying, oh, you don't need polygamy. All you need is eternal marriage. And this is one of the reasons why, you know, it was so hard for the Mormons to give up polygamy, you know, during that transitional period, 1890 to 1904, is because they did believe it was necessary for the highest salvation. And, you know, that's a real change that our church has gone through. And that's one of the reasons why it's so hard for them to go back and look at this period, the polygamy period.
Mm-hmm. I think Todd's exactly right on that. I mean, these people, for example, that moved to Mexico, that sold their land, left their families behind, traveled hundreds of miles to live in a new foreign land to them where they wouldn't see their families again, they didn't do that because they thought polygamy was going to be fun again. They did it because they believed this is what they had to do to achieve the highest degree of the celestial kingdom. And so Todd is right. There was this very difficult, wrenching period when the church had to give that up, forced to by federal prosecution from the U.S. government, had to give up that doctrine. But yet the thing that's difficult, and I think is difficult for particularly women today, is that doctrine is still in our canonized scripture. It's still in Doctrine and Covenants 132, as Brian points out. We still see it in our temple rituals and ceremonies, and it's still kind of hanging over us, if you will. And it's hard for women. It's hard to know that a man can be sealed to more than one woman in the temple, but a woman cannot be sealed to more than one man, even if she wants to. Again, that's polygamy.
Well, I would respond to Todd's comments that, what you're saying is very popular with the fundamentalists, that it was commanded then, therefore it's always commanded. And yet I would challenge
anyone. I didn't say that. I just said at that time it was accepted, as necessary for the highest salvation.
Well, and I think that's what the fundamentalists, the point I would make is that no leader, even during that period, ever said that polygamy is required for every man in the celestial kingdom. It was a unique commandment between the 1840s and 1890. The commandment was removed with the First Manifesto. And yet, if we look at the Book of Mormon, we can look at lots of examples where there are very righteous monogamists who are promised every blessing that God can bestow. So the fundamentalists want to say it was commanded then, it's still commanded today. And yet, there's no leader who ever said that had to be true. And that's the important point. They were encouraging everybody, and they were saying, you got to do it now because it was commanded then. But commandments can be revoked, and that's my belief, that in 1890 it was revoked due to the unrighteousness of the U.S. government, and monogamy was once again commanded, just as it had been in the Book of Mormon.
Boy, we have a real disagreement here, Brian, because I agree with you about revoking. There's no problem there. And, the church changed, but my understanding is there are many quotes from high church leaders saying polygamy is necessary for the highest salvation.
And to add to what Todd is saying, it was certainly understood by the saints at this time as being required. That was certainly the perception that it was being required in order to achieve that.
And, of course, I wish Mike Quinn were here to talk about this, or B. Carmen Hardy, two great authorities on post-manifesto polygamy. And I wish Mike Quinn was quoted or cited in that article. But,
yeah. That was a big omission for sure. Because he paid a big price for writing that article in Dialogue of Volume 18, yeah.
Let me just say one last thing, Todd. Yes, I do. I strongly disagree with what you said as far as this. I agree it was taught that way, but I don't understand where you're actually disagreeing with me, unless you are saying that it was taught during that period that every man, either before or after that period, had to be a polygamist, because that clearly did not happen.
And if they wanted the highest salvation,
the highest degree in the celestial kingdom.
I would challenge you to find one quote to support that. I would challenge either one of you to come up with one quote to show that any leader during that period said that for any person living at any time or place on this planet, they had to be a polygamist to get the highest level of the celestial kingdom. That's the challenge.
Or they will have to be a polygamist in the next life.
Right, either one of those. I've looked really
Brian,
hard.
Brian, I'm surprised. I thought this was general knowledge, but
right, it's
we can talk
tradition.
About it offline.
It's general tradition. That's fine, but it's important. It's important because the fundamentalists grab onto these traditions and they think they're based upon actual quotations from the brethren, and I haven't found them. Maybe you've got them, Todd, and that'd be really good. Barbara, if you've got some, do send them to me.
And listeners, please jump in. We can throw them in the discussion at the website, or you send them to me, and I'll pass them along to Brian, and somehow we'll make it known, because I'm thrilled for this debate.
Yeah, and I'd be happy to share experiences of families who said, this is why we moved to Mexico, because we knew we had to do this. We were taught this. So it was certainly the perception at the time.
Yeah. Or maybe they were taught by a leader for them, and then therefore they generalized it for everybody, and that may be where Brian's place.
These folks started out in Salt Lake City.
I think of quotes from, Brigham Young and John Taylor and so on.
Yeah, I'd like to see them all, because I've spent a lot of time looking for them, and I don't think they exist, but heck, you can miss that stuff, so I'd love to see them.
We must be having some problem with definitions, Brian.
Well, Brian, let me think. What Brian is saying is that it's saying every single person who ever has lived will need to be in some sort of plurality going on now or in the next life. And so he's not, he of course knows that there's plenty of people saying that it's you know, a key to salvation and all that stuff meaning. But Brian, you're kind of saying is that you're thinking most of they're saying this needs to be a practice, but it doesn't need to be for everybody.
Well, I'm just saying what the leaders were saying, and they said it's commanded in some dispensations, but it is not applicable unless it's commanded in that dispensation. Joseph F. Smith actually gave a really nice definition. I'm trying to find it here, but I can't find it. But no leader has said that if you want to be in the top of the celestial kingdom, you got to be a polygamist no matter where or when you lived. I haven't found it. But again, I'm open for your
enlightenment. We're going to have to share some emails, so, Brian.
There you go, Todd. You can do that, and we can put it online.
Good. I'm excited.
Here's just one sample. It's cited in my work, but here's something I just found quickly at my fingertips. A personal example from a woman named Mary Theresa Thompson Call, who became the first wife to Anson Bowen Call in 1885. And before she married him, this is from her personal history, and it's written in third person, but she says, when she was asked by Bowen to be his wife, she asked him if he intended to live the principle of plural marriage, stating that she wanted to be worthy of the highest blessings available in the celestial kingdom, and if he did not intend to take a plural wife, she would not marry him. I can give more direct quotes. I need to go to my writings and find them, but that was something that actually surprised me, Brian, when I started my research, that people believed this, and you know, they weren't coming up with it out of thin air. These were, you know, faithful Latter-day Saints in Salt
and
City.
I don't really deny that they believed it. That's not the issue. The issue is, was it taught as the doctrine of the church? And I found the quote. I hate to go back and forth, but I've done this with so many fundamentalists over the last 25 years that this is something taught. If you've got something, I'd love to see it. But in 1878, Joseph F. Smith, he was an apostle. He said, plural marriage is a principle that pertains to eternal life. In other words, to endless lives or eternal increase. It is a law of the gospel pertaining to the celestial kingdom, applicable to all gospel dispensations when commanded and not otherwise, and neither acceptable to God or binding on man unless given by commandment. That's Journal of Discourses. And that just sums it up. And people want to come in with these personal feelings or something. This is the global view. And it's and no leader ever said everybody's going to have to do it or if they're to get into the top, at least that I found. And I'm sincere when I say maybe I've missed something, but mm-hmm. to quote some personal belief, and I've got a set of quotes too of individuals who may have thought that it was needed, but that's not ever been the official teachings of our leaders. That's my position.
Mm-hmm. Well, I don't disagree with, you know, the where he's talking about when commanded, it has to be commanded. That isn't the issue. The issue is, you know, the people believed that, you know, the highest level of the celestial kingdom could be arrived at only by polygamy. You know, and I think they got that from teachings of church leaders.
And I mean, well, and those are the teachings I'm seeking to find
because
I've looked hard and I haven't been able to find.
Yeah,
but of course they were living in a time when it was commanded, so they're not really thinking in this nuanced way.
Right. That's kind of what I think has happened. And I'm sorry to be a little aggressive there, Todd, but it is a tradition. And I just felt very strongly, look, we can't let the listeners think that this has ever been taught over the pulpit as official doctrine unless there's some good documentation, which I haven't been able to find.
So what about, Brian, in D&C 132, when it says, he that abideth not this law can in no wise enter into my glory, but shall be damned, saith the Lord.
Yeah, is that verse 4 or 6?
What do you make of that?
The law is eternal marriage. It's plainly stated in verse 19. If a monogamous couple live worthily and they're sealed by proper authority, then they become gods. 19 and 20 are not quoted by fundamentalists very often, or if they quote them, they always put little brackets in there to redefine what it says because it doesn't say what they want it to say. Monogamy and eternal marriage is the law, and then plural marriage is an adjunct to allow all worthy women to enjoy it. Again, go ahead and roll your eyes. I know that's what's happening, but that's what it says. To me, it's just real plain, but I'm getting so much pushback. I don't know. We'll just see how it plays out, but that's what I believe.
Thanks, guys. Barbara, is there any more that you want to talk about the third thing? Otherwise, you know, and once we finish you guys talking about the third one, I'll give everybody a chance to kind of do some final summation type stuff. But Barbara, anything more like that's just bugging you about that third one?
No, just another comment. I just wanted to point out and make this clear that I really, really admire the people who sought to follow their church leaders and make these incredible sacrifices to live polygamy.
Nice.
They were noble people. So many of their families were very strong. They raised great kids who went on to become amazing leaders, not only in the church, but in the United States. And so in criticizing some of the aspects of the essays, I don't want to come across as criticizing the members of the church who practiced polygamy because they believed they were doing the right thing. They were believed they were doing God's will, and a lot of polygamous marriages weren't lived well, but a lot of them were. And I just want to commend those people, the faith of those people. I admire that. I don't advocate polygamy personally, but I do want to point out my admiration for these folks that made such tremendous sacrifices to live this.
Wonderful.
And then just as a final concluding comment, I think that with these essays, I'm thrilled that the conversation on this topic has been blown open, and that we can now openly talk about these things that historians have kind of just been able to talk about with each other. But I could never talk about these things that I've been learning about in my ward or with friends or neighbors. But I think the fact that they appear on the church's website now, it makes a safer space to be able to talk about these issues and start working through them. And we're not done yet. I think this is just the first step, and I hope that more increasing information can be added and more nuanced information can be added and more acknowledgement of the realities of our polygamous past can be discussed.
That sounds like a final statement from you. do you want me to loop back around with you after I get these guys to give a final statement?
It doesn't have to be, but yeah, that's my final thought.
Okay. Thank you so much, pal. Really appreciate you being here and being on. Todd, I'll throw it to you for a final, you know, anything that you want to say, even if it's a reiteration of, you know, earlier points. What would you like
to say? Yeah, Barbara, that was very eloquent. I just want to say ditto.
Nice.
You know, I feel about these essays kind of like I feel about Bushman's Rough Stone Rolling, you know. And, you know, in some ways I disagreed with his treatment of various things, you know, one of which was polygamy. But in another way, you know, I realized, you know, what an important step forward that book was. And that introduced a lot of church members to the idea that Joseph Smith had plural wives. And even though he didn't, you know, like when I read that book, I had a background in obviously reading a lot about polygamy, you know, reading a history geek, reading polygamy a lot. A lot of church, average church members are not history geeks, you know, and so reading what Bushman had to say about Joseph Smith's polygamy was just blew them away. And so I think these, you know, so I've come to kind of had a admiration for Bushman's book, even though for what it did, you know, even though I disagree with some aspects of it, you know, and again, like these essays, he did quote, you know, liberal people like me and Dan Vogel in his notes, you know, and so, I feel like these essays haven't gone, you know, they're a wonderful first step, you know, and there will be more progress later, you know, but they're a wonderful first step, and I applaud them, and I'm really happy they're there.
Thank you. Thanks for being on, my friend. Wow.
Sure.
Super amazing. Brian, where would you leave us tonight?
You know, I like the essays quite an awful lot, especially if I think Barbara was eloquent. It was excellent. And let me just add that while I was doing my research, I was down at the Church History Library and I met with a church historian to gain access to certain documents. We were just going over the list. And after I had a approval for everything. They never turned me down for anything, or Don Bradley when he was working for me. But after we got done going through my items, then he went over and he closed the door of the room we were in, and he came over and he sat down and he looked opposite of me and he says, "Brian, now tell me the real scoop. What are you finding here with this polygamy?" Now, here's a church historian who says it's been a tiptoe item. We've had to tiptoe around it. Even the historians for, I think, decades were having to kind of tiptoe around this issue. And now we see less than 5 years later, here it is with all of its warts. I mean, they pulled no punches. Every controversial item dealing with Nauvoo polygamy is mentioned in there. Whether it's mentioned well or to the satisfaction of, is another issue. But they're all there, which, as you know, these gospel topic papers can be discussed in church and Sunday school, and you're not going to be excommunicated for doing so. So I think that it's just it's a huge advance, not only for church historians, if you will, but also for the membership. So I applaud that. And let me just thank Barbara and also Todd. I'll look forward to getting together on this other issue. And for those that are listening, if you go to my website, I'll go ahead and post Todd's and mind correspondence there, so you can see what types of quotes we're exchanging there here in the future, if we're able to make that work there. So, but thanks for having me.
Dude, thanks for being on. And again, I wanted to reiterate a point I made earlier. I'm glad that you are a voice for the theology. I mean, of course, Todd, you had theology all of yours, and Barbara, you know, clearly we've been talking theology as well as history here. But the idea that there was revelatory stuff going on, that it was genuine, I really do think that gets left behind so many times. So I'm thrilled that you've joined this debate, even though it probably wasn't the happiest circumstance for you to when your sister married into that, and all of a sudden you said, "Whoa, what am I being called into here?" Thank you.
Thank you, Dan.
Well, listeners, I want to just kind of take a minute here at the end. I'm often kind of, I receive lots of notes and things from many of you, and a lot of them talk about how, one guy called it my jovial spirit or something, and that, a fresh energy or whatever that I kind of offer in these podcasts. I'll let you know that this has been a hard week for me. I mean, polygamy is always hard when I go there. I don't want you to think that, whatever peace within Mormonism that I've attained, that I don't get down, that when, you think of the reality, when you think of all the pain, when you think of all the difficulties of this, and to me, it is completely still up in the air for me as to whether God was involved with this. I don't even know that I like the language of God allowed it to happen and then still went ahead and blessed other people. I'm far less certain in all those areas, but so I just wanted you to know I have a hard time with this issue too, and so live in your pain if you need to, live in your sorrow and things like that, but more than anything else, I just want to kind of encourage everybody to do what I think we all are called to do, which is Mormonism doesn't rise or fall on its history. Mormonism doesn't rise or fall on Joseph Smith's reputation. Mormonism doesn't rise and fall on anything. It is simply us and our connection, and if we feel that God's called us to be with this people. I found lots of good reasons in Mormonism. It's the symbol system. I love most of our scriptures, or at least love being in our scriptures, and all the invitations it gives for me to take deep dives with God myself. I find richness in our stories and everything like that, that I feel like I live a spiritual life within Mormonism, and even though polygamy can drag me down, and even though so many different issues can drag me down here and stuff like that, I just, I don't want anyone to feel like this has to be make or break for them. Maybe it will turn out to be, and you've got your own reasons and things like that, but I really think that the gospel is always pointing us to God, to our own relationship, to our own spiritual walk, and Mormonism has many gifts that I think can help so many of us, but, clearly sometimes it's painful and hard as well. So if I can just throw that out there and not bore my panelists, tonight's panelists with that, I just wanted to kind of talk with our listeners there. Thank you again for being part of this, you guys. It was amazing. What generous souls you are to spend this time.
Thanks. That was interesting.
Thanks, Dan. Thanks to Todd. Thanks to Barbara.
Thanks, Brian. Thanks, Barbara.
Thanks, everyone. And I just wanted to thank Brian and Todd again for all of the research that they've done. And their research has certainly informed my writing about post-manifesto polygamy. So I appreciate it.
Well, I look forward to reading those things you've written.
Yeah, me too.
Yes. Thanks. I look forward to them being in print.
There you go.
And you guys, I'll link to everything that we've kind of talked about here, but feel free to email me or something, Todd, and all of you guys, if there's anything else I should link to on the Mormon Matters website so people can look at stuff that's available. So thanks so much. And while everybody's there, of course, at the website, there's a donate button, there's a subscribe button. Anything that you do in terms of financial support is so, so appreciated. This, again, is what I do for a living, a big part of it anyway. And if you do, click on the links for the books and things that are there, it's taking you to an Amazon Associates page of Mormon Matters. So the link will send you into the Mormon Matters bookshelf, and anything you buy in there does count as a certain percentage does go for me. So if you're going to buy things from Amazon anyway, go through the link once you're in Amazon from there, you will actually, anything else you purchase or something there would also go for me. So it's kind of just a neat little, hopefully painless way for anybody there that actually still brings some benefit to me. So sorry to talk money here at the end. Again, thanks to my guests, Barbara, Brian, Todd, amazing. And I wish everybody a good night. Cue the music.
Thank you for joining us today on Mormon Matters Podcast. To discuss this podcast with others, please check us out at mormonmatters.org. To keep this podcast alive or to join our support community, please consider a tax-deductible donation today at mormonmatters.org. Music for this podcast was brought to you by Brittany and Clayton Pixton. The Mormon Matters logo was generously provided by StudioCase.com. Thank you for listening.